my bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, but I'm busted. I got a cow that went by and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that gets bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Dreyfuss, who's an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Dreyfuss.
Thanks very much.
And we're speaking, Robert, on the one-year anniversary when Iraqis celebrated Iraq Day with the departure of U.S. troops on December 31st, 2011. And 1 year later, it's beginning to look like Iraq could be coming apart at the seams.
Well, I hope you're not trying to make the point that the United States should have stayed around in Iraq, or else it would have come apart at the seams. That was kind of the conservative argument during the late Bush years and the early Obama years. In fact, Iraq has been coming apart ever since we removed the cornerstone of Iraq, which was Saddam Hussein's government back in 2003. And ever since then, it's fractured along ethnic and sectarian lines, and a lot of its neighbors have intervened, and it verged on civil war for several years in 2006 and 2007. And so it's still a mess. It was a mess years ago, and it's a mess now, and it doesn't look like it's getting any better.
Well, I'm reminded of what Colin Powell apparently told President Bush, who was not given any dissenting opinions by anybody, and for reasons I'm still mystified by, his own father did not weigh in. Brent Scowcroft, his father's national security advisor, desperately understood the mistake that the neocons in the Bush administration, most largely led by Dick Cheney, were about to make. But Bush got no counsel to warn him, except what Colin Powell apparently said, using the pottery bomb analogy, if you break it, you own it. So we broke Iraq, but we left it in pieces, and who owns it now? As far as I can tell, Iran owns it.
But we don't own it, so it wasn't Pottery Barn. And by the way, Pottery Barn doesn't actually have that rule. If you go into a Pottery Barn and break something, they'll say, oh, I'm sorry, that's happened, and they'll clean it up, but you don't have to buy it. So even Colin Powell was wrong about the Pottery Barn rule. Iraq is a fractured state. We broke all the institutions of power. We shattered the economy, we destroyed the army, we destroyed the Ba'ath Party, we shut down all the ministries, and really they didn't get rebuilt properly. So Iraq is a catastrophe, and it'll take a generation to recover from the damage of the, you know, almost 10-year-long war that happened there. And what we see happening now is the consolidation of power by sort of a pro-Iranian government under Prime Minister Maliki, who spent years living in Iran, whose party was supported by Iran for decades before the U.S. Invasion, going back to the 1970s. Maliki is doing what most leaders in a vacuum do in a former authoritarian state. He's aggregating power to himself, and he's one by one systematically trying to knock off his rivals, but really not having all that much success, because the Kurdish parties to the north and east of Iraq are really armed and have their own military and paramilitary forces and aren't submitting to rule by Baghdad. And the Sunni, not quite warlords, but powers in the western part of Iraq are growing increasingly angry about Maliki's efforts to imprison or accuse or repress their various leaders, including, you know, the finance minister and the vice president and others who were opponents of Maliki. And now the Sunnis in Iraq are emboldened by the fact that a religiously based insurgency is gaining momentum next door in Syria. And so there's a lot of cross-pollination between the Syrian revolt and the revolt of the Sunnis in Iraq. And both of them, in turn, draw strength from folks in the Arab Gulf states like Saudi Arabia and others that are, you know, funneling money and support and weapons to the Sunnis in both of these countries. So it's a very dangerous situation.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, who's an investigative journalist who has written extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism, and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. So your point's well taken that we shouldn't tie in the withdrawal of the United States to the fact that Iraq is falling apart. We broke it, and if anybody ended up owning it, it's Iran. But now Iran is watching its major foreign policy success in Syria. Iran's essentially losing its grip there, or the Assad family seem to be losing their grip. And this will, and you mentioned that this is emboldening the Sunni in the west of Anbar province of Iraq. There's been a series of demonstrations now in Anbar province by the Sunnis because of Maliki's order to arrest the finance minister. Even the Shia leader, Muqtada al-Sadr, has gone and held a press conference yesterday criticizing Maliki's government for not responding to the people and even saying that he would go to Anbar to join in the demonstrations. And obviously, he's a kind of wily character and not at all trustworthy. But surely this indicates that this government that we've helped put in there, Maliki's government, is completely unresponsive to the public. He's consolidating power. And what's happening to all that oil revenue? Where's it going? There's no evidence that the condition and the lives of the average Iraqis are going anywhere but down.
There's a whole bunch of interrelated issues here. Maliki is certainly, in the last year or two, taken a number of steps that indicate that he's moving closer to Iran. He's integrated some fairly radical Shiite militia groups, really terrorist groups, into his political establishment. He's released a number of people, including a guy named Dakduk, who was an outright terrorist and supporter of Hezbollah, from prison. He's allowed Iran to transit Iraq in bringing supplies to Assad, even though the United States put a lot of pressure on Iran not to release Dakduk and not to allow the Iranians to use, overflight of Iraq to supply Assad. All things being equal, I think Iran would find it difficult to control Iraq as Iraq began to develop its own oil industry and its own independence because Iraqi nationalism would start to assert itself. But problem is Iraq is caught between all these conflicting crises. And in order to bolster his position, I think Maliki, rather than trying to act as a nationalist, which he flirted with a couple of years ago, is now moving closer to Iran. And I think he'll move even closer to Iran as the crisis in Syria moves into its end game. So Iraq, has the potential to be independent because of its oil, because it can produce a vast amount of oil exports, which can allow Iraq to develop countries, ties with countries like, let's say, China and India and others who might want to buy Iraqi oil independently of the United States, even Japan and other countries. So So Iraq has a lot of potential, but it's not capitalizing on that potential because it's caught, you know, in between a lot of big powers that are trying to, gain, I guess, hegemony in the region. And the biggest conflict of all is between Iran and the United States. Now, we don't know what's going to happen in the next year or so. I am quite sure that Obama, President Obama, does not want war with Iran, and I'm sure that he will work, I think, fairly hard to reach an agreement with Iran, although it may take a year or two. That's something that alarms some of the other countries in the region, like Saudi Arabia, and so they're angling to increase their leverage so that the United States doesn't make a deal with Iran that would work, you know, against their influence. And again, Iraq is sort of caught in the middle of all of that. Same thing with Turkey, which is a very powerful country, both economically and militarily in the region. It's a NATO member, and it has a great deal of concern about Iraq and the problem of the Kurds, because the Kurds have a huge presence inside Turkey and the southeast part of that country. So it's a huge regional tangle, and I think it would be enormously useful if the United States and Iran could come to some sort of agreement, because that would then ease a lot of the pressure and the motives for conflict throughout that whole part of the world.
But there's two questions that still remain. What's happening to the oil revenues that are coming in now? And even if the U.S. makes a deal with Iran, Iraq could start to unravel, which it appears to be starting to do, if Syria, if the Assads fall, and you have a Muslim Brotherhood government in Syria that's friendly towards the Sunnis in Anbar province. You've already got the Kurds wanting to go their own way, and they've got their own oil. They seem to have sovereignty over the oil there. There's also oil, I believe, in Anbar, or at least potential. It seems like it's heading towards balkanization, even if the United States and Iran make a deal.
That's a worst-case scenario. I mean, certainly the whole region could begin to be embroiled in a very complicated ethnic and sectarian conflict that would spill over into Lebanon, into Turkey, of course, Syria and Iraq and elsewhere. Let's hope, you know, God forbid that doesn't happen. As far as what's happened to Iraq's oil revenue, I mean, oil revenue for Iraq and for many countries like that are oil producers is the prime, sort of underpinning of their entire economy. So what they're doing with their oil revenue is they're using it to pay for imports of everything that they need, from military supplies to basic, you know, foods and medicines that they import, to technology and infrastructure needs, especially, by the way, for the oil industry. They need tens of billions, probably $100 billion, to rebuild and expand their oil industry in terms of, you know, pipelines and refineries and new wells and shipping terminals and everything else, if they're going to expand oil production from whatever it is now, about 2.5 million barrels a day, to up to 10 million barrels a day. They could have a fourfold increase in oil exports over the next 10 or 15 years. And so, you know, don't forget, this is a very poor country whose economy has been shattered. So what are they doing with their oil revenue? I mean, my goodness, they're trying to rebuild the country, which has been devastated, and it's beyond their capacity.
And presumably the country that devastated their country, the United States, in a war that looks like the Americans lost, the Iraqis lost, and perhaps the Iranians won. Are they ponying up and helping rebuild this country?
Well, I don't know if the United States is particularly wanted there, but certainly there are a number of American companies that are involved. It just, Iraq on its own, despite having oil revenues, as I said, it's still a poor country, so unless it's going to get aid and charity, which is not too likely, it's just limping by here. It's not some great booming recovery economy. And so that's why I say it's going to take many, many years for Iraq to get to the point where its economy is back on track. The United States and anybody else is not going to come in there and help. I mean, we've left, and the rest of the coalition is gone, and Iraq is now on its own. And as a country trying to, you know, scramble by on its own, it's having a great amount of difficulty.
And it's certainly forgotten by the United States and by the American people, and there'd be no way in the world that anybody could raise, go to the hill and ask for money for Iraq at this moment or at any time in the foreseeable future. But nevertheless, you know, it is a year since the United States withdrew, and that's one of the reasons I'm calling you today, Robert Dreyfus, is to get a sense of where we are a year later with these constant bombings and these demonstrations that seem to be getting more intense now in the Sunni areas against the Maliki's crude and sort of clumsy use of power. He's now threatening, al-Maliki's now threatening to use force against the demonstrators.
Well, it's difficult to find a new political balance, and it's hard to see who might be an alternative to Maliki. I mean, they do have a parliamentary system, and so it's not a dictatorship. It is a fledgling democracy, let's call it. If there were a majority in the parliament that would comprise, you know, the Kurds, let's say, and the Sunnis, and Muqtada al-Sadr's forces, among them, they have enough votes in parliament to have a vote of no confidence against Maliki and to force him to resign. Problem is, those various opponents of his can't agree among themselves and would also have great difficulty finding somebody to replace him. In other words, once we get rid of Maliki, what then? It certainly couldn't be a Kurdish prime minister. It couldn't be a Sunni. So it would have to be a Shiite prime minister because they represent, two-thirds of the country are Shiite. And then you get down to people like Ayad Alawi, who is a Shiite, who has a lot of support among the Sunnis, but he is not too popular these days. There's a former prime minister who came before Maliki who might be a candidate. You couldn't find someone who would be anti-Iranian because the Iranians would probably act pretty forcefully to undermine that person. So it's a very difficult political situation, and that's why Maliki has been able to survive so long. He's ironically had the support of both Iran and the United States for the past several years, and he, you know, knows how to play that game, so he can keep both Washington and Tehran sort of in his corner because there doesn't seem to be an immediate alternative.
The Kurdish leader is in Germany now with health problems. They're pretty much independent, and they seem to have their own oil revenues as well. Let's just without being apocalyptic, if these demonstrations continue, if Maliki is, who doesn't appear to be very deft, comes down with a heavy hand, things are likely to go unhinged. But just go forward to what's Iran going to do when they lose Syria and the Anbar Sunnis are emboldened by their brethren who are now would be running Syria? That's a different world we're talking about.
Yeah, and I'm not apocalyptic about it. I mean, certainly there are very dangerous things that could happen here. I think the Iranians have figured out by now that Assad is gone. I think the Russians have concluded that as well. So it's only a matter of time. And so the first thing that both Iran and Russia would do would be to try to work somehow to establish, if not friendly, at least, you know, tolerable relations with a new coalition in Syria. And they're not all crazy Islamists, and they're not all Muslim Brotherhood, and so who knows? I mean, maybe something will emerge out of the ashes in Syria. Let's hope it doesn't go the other direction toward a civil war. Same thing with Iraq. I disagree with you. I think Maliki is quite deft. That's why he's been able to stay in power this long, and he seems to know, you know, how to balance heavy-handed use of force with behind-the-scenes deal-making. And so my guess is it's more likely that Iraq will muddle along than it will dissolve into civil war itself. Iran, let's be hopeful for 2013 that Iran sees its best interest in reaching an accord with the United States, that Obama feels the same way, and that he keeps the lid on Israel, which he seems to have done effectively so far, so that the Israelis don't attack Iran. And as long as he can keep Israel in its box, then he'll have maneuvering room in Washington to try to make a deal with Iran. Certainly he's freer now in the second term to make concessions to Iran, which he may not have been able to do so easily when he was preparing to run for re-election. Now that Obama is re-elected, he has a lot more maneuverability in conceding to Iran, let's say, to allow them to continue to enrich uranium under guidelines and inspections and so forth. And the Iranians, in turn, have a reason to make that kind of deal, too, especially if it can lead to the end of sanctions. And so, before we go all apocalyptic about the whole Middle East is falling apart, let's remember that people who live in those countries have gigantic incentives to avoid going over the cliff. And I think they'll all work pretty hard to make sure that doesn't happen. Let's just hope that the United States, doesn't do anything stupid to make it worse in the next year or two.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Robert Dreyfus.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Dreyfus, who's an investigative journalist who's been writing extensively on Iraq, the war on terrorism and national security for The Nation, Mother Jones, Rolling Stone, and as a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And we spoke, of course, on the anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Stan Misrahi and Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.